Hello?
Hello?
Hi, is that you, Jim?
Yep, it is. How are you?
I'm well, how are you?
Yep.
Hello, everyone. This is Kristen Jesperson from the Tamarack Coalition. We're going to get started here momentarily. Thank you for joining us. First and foremost, I would like to hear from our participants that you can hear me. So if you could type into the chat box that that I am audible, that would be great. Okay, great. Confirmation, you can hear me. That's a good start. Well, welcome, everyone. This is our seventh webinar of the Tamarack Coalition Funding Webinar Series. Today we're going to be talking about restoration, funding for restoration in Utah. We're going to be hearing from a number of state of Utah agencies and the different programs that they offer to fund restoration. Again, my name is Kristen Jesperson. I am the funding program coordinator with the Tamarack Coalition. And just in case you are joining us and you received a flyer publicizing this event that did not include the website URL, I apologize for that. That website URL is acuconference.com/customer/join/ And all of the information in the flyer is accurate. You can call. You can type in the number 1-800-920-7487, then the access number 7447-8972, and then your name. I will be monitoring and potentially repeating that throughout the conference if I note that there are people on the phone who can't access the website. This event is being recorded and so can be accessed in the future, and the presentations will be posted online. So let's get started. A few basic ground rules about web conferencing. All of you participants will be muted during the presentations, and so we will take questions after those have all been completed. If you have questions throughout the course of the presentations, please take the time to write those down and direct them and ask a specific presenter. So when we are at the Q&A session, you can target your presenter for your questions. In lieu of a sign sheet, please sign into the chat box by typing your name and your organization and your watershed if possible. That helps our presenters know who's on the call. When you log in, you have the option of choosing a phone or web only. Please choose phone only, or just mute your computer so that you don't hear from both the phone and the computer, and it prevents feedback. When you do ask questions, please mention who you are and your affiliation. And if you have a question and you want to ask that and you know the presentations are starting to conclude, you can press star 1. And that's how we'll figure out who's interested in asking questions. And then we will have a survey set up at the end of the presentation that you can log on to, and that link is here on this slide, and I will share that with you towards the end of the webinar as well. A little bit about the Tamarack Coalition. We are a nonprofit organization based in Grand Junction, and we work with various partnerships throughout the southwestern U.S. to facilitate the restoration of riparian lands. And most of you work with us already, but if you're interested in learning more, you can find our website at www.tamarackcoalition.org, and you can email me if you have any questions about future funding webinars. Some of the webinars that we have planned in the future include funding for restoration in Arizona and common pitfalls of grant writing and fundraising. We're always taking ideas for future webinars if you have a subject that interests you, so feel free to email me if those occur to you. All right, we are going to get started with our first presenter momentarily. Our first presenter is Chris Wood. He's the Habitat Program Manager in the Southeastern Region for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. He currently oversees the management of lands owned by the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources in the Southeastern Region. He's actively involved in habitat restoration work on public and private lands and part of the partnership that is implementing Utah's Watershed Restoration Initiative, which he will be speaking about today. I will pull up your presentation, Chris, and then you can unmute and let me know that you are audible. Are you there?
Okay. Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Thanks so much.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm speaking about the Utah's Watershed Restoration Initiative. It's kind of evolved over the years. It started out around 2004. It was originally called the Sagebrush Initiative due to the large-scale sagebrush die-off that we are seeing throughout the state. And then it evolved into what we call the Habitat Restoration Initiative. And then about 2005 or so, it became the Watershed Restoration Initiative, or called WRI. There's a few reasons we call it the Watershed Restoration Initiative. One, that encompasses kind of large-scale areas. We try to look beyond boundaries and ownership boundaries and do large-scale restoration projects that not only benefit wildlife, which was the initial focus, but also watersheds. And so we're trying to restore watersheds. There's three legs to this initiative. One is we are trying to improve wildlife and biological diversity. We're also trying to improve water quality and yield for all uses. And then third, we're trying to improve and increase opportunities for sustainable use. Before I specifically talk about some of the how this program relates to riparian habitats and restoration and tamaracks and Russian olive and some of these things that we're probably mostly concerned about in this webinar, let me kind of just step back and share with you some of the things we're doing on a statewide level. So most of the WRI projects are not necessarily riparian related. A lot of the work we're doing takes place on the uplands, in the forest, but really this initiative tries to capture all different types of lands and habitats. Here's a picture on the screen of some work that we do in middle elevation areas. This is a chain harrow. A lot of the work that we do is to improve mule deer habitat, elk habitat, and sage grouse habitat. Those are kind of the big species that we hear a lot about from our constituents. And so in this particular project, I believe it's on the Henry Mountains, we're using a chain harrow to try to decrease some of the encroaching pinyon and juniper trees. This chain harrow, we probably flew on seed on this project, and this chain harrow is removing some of those smaller trees and getting that seed into the ground. Here's another example of a tool that we use when we implement WRI projects. Again, we're trying to improve mid-elevation habitats. This is a scalper. We're trying to plant bitter brush in this particular project. And then, of course, we use this is kind of a skid steer with a fecon head. It's kind of a mini bullhog. We use the larger piece of equipment, but kind of the same idea. It's called a bullhog. And again, WRI funds projects that use these types of equipment, both on pinyon and juniper landscapes, but also in tamaracks and Russian olive areas. And then this picture is a guy with a chainsaw. He's doing a simple lop and scatter project. Again, we're trying to remove the encroaching pinyon and juniper trees, trying to retain that diverse understory of sagebrush and grasses and forbs to benefit a whole bunch of different species and try to improve the landscape. And then finally, this picture is of an aspen burn up on the West Tavaputs in Utah. WRI has funded prescribed burns in the past on many occasions on private lands, on state lands, on federal lands. We've done aspen burns like this, but we've also funded riparian burns, areas we want to burn out tamaracks. We also funded a wetland burn there on the Matheson Preserve in Moab. And then finally, just talk a little bit about riparian restoration. Riparian restoration is a component of the WRI program. Probably about, 20% of the projects we have in Utah, maybe a little less than that, are focused on riparian and wetland areas. In the southeastern part of the state, that number is a little higher, probably maybe even one-third of the projects we see come through our region have a riparian component. And a lot of those riparian projects are removing tamaracks and Russian olive and dealing with the aftermath, treating invasive weeds that come in afterwards, and then trying to plant to a native, trying to plant native species in this case. This WRI grant funded both the removal and the containerized stock of, that we used to replant. So I use WRI a lot. I'm also going to be using the word UPCD, and those terms can be kind of confusing. Basically, UPCD is the group of people or the meeting that we have. It's called the Utah Partners for Conservation and Development. It's a group of people that meet together. In the fall and winter, we meet together monthly. In the summer, we meet twice in the summer to go on field tours. And so this group is made up of government agency personnel, resource managers, private landowners, nonprofit organization leaders and resource managers, really county commissioners. It's quite diverse. And these people meet together in what's called UPCD. And so it's called a UPCD meeting. And basically at the UPCD meeting is where the WRI projects are presented and approved and then eventually ranked. In our state of Utah, we have five different regions where these UPCD meetings take place. I'm in the southeastern region, so every when we meet in the winter, it's once a month. We go to Green River. But as you can see here, they meet throughout the state, and the meetings are a little bit different. The chairmen of each region is a little different as well. Those chairmen, the chairman of each group changes place about every 2 years. In our region, it's the BLM fuels guy. I think in the central region, it's a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist. In the northeast region, it's a county commissioner. So all these regions run a little bit differently, but basically these groups are established to approve and work together on WRI projects. We have a website. You can see the web page. On this website, there's numerous features, but basically I'd encourage you to go on our website and fill out a username and password, and then I think, you know, within a day they can approve you, and you can go on the website and have access to all kinds of information. Some of the information you have access to is, you know, what's going on the ground. You can look at current project proposals. You can look at projects that have happened in the past. There's actually an interactive GIS map you can look at. So you can look at a particular part of Utah, zoom in really closely, and on that map it'll show you projects that are currently happening and completed projects, and you can click on that area and you can read about, you know, who the project manager is and what their goals were, before and after pictures, completion reports, all kinds of information. So it's pretty interesting. Also on that website, we have some scientific literature. Basically, all the methods and tools that we use have some scientific basis, and they've been proven to be good, effective tools for the most part. And so some of that literature that backs up some of our work is on the website as well. And then we have a calendar that shows when the next meetings are. Like I mentioned a little earlier, we're kind of the time of year we are now, UPC meetings aren't really happening. They start up again in October. But what we're doing now is we're having field tours. So this summer, we in the southeastern region, and I imagine the other UPCD groups are similar, we have two field tours going on this summer. And they and the idea of the field tour is to go look at projects that WRI has funded, see how they turned out, see what we have learned from them, and so forth. So also on the website is a list of all of our partners. You can see here we team up with a lot of different organizations and people, and also private landowners. And together the names you see listed here are actually on our statewide charter. Not listed on our statewide charter are other organizations like the Nature Conservancy or the Turkey Federation, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Groups like that are also part of UPCD, but aren't necessarily listed on our charter. And so basically all these groups, including the ones that aren't on our charter, can be a part of our regional UPCD teams. And those teams meet together and approve and rank projects. A quick timeline. Grants are available starting July 1st of every year. Between now and about December 1st, because we're just approaching the end of our timeline here. So we've already approved all the projects. They've already been ranked, and they're going to be approved in the next week or two. And we'll, in the next week or two, we will know which projects have funding for July 1st. And on July 1st, we will work with all those partners who receive funding and do cooperative agreements to transfer the money from the Division of Wildlife to these organizations. So right now, a lot of people are starting to think about the following year, so, you know, 2014, and projects for 2014. And what that means is they're going out to the field, they're trying to figure out what areas they want to treat or what areas they want to improve and restore, and they're going into the database, and they're writing proposals. In our database, there's a proposal form, and there's always different fields, and you can go in there and fill out each field, and it kind of walks you through the entire proposal process. In October, we'll start meeting again, and we'll have meetings in October, November, and January. And at those meetings, we'll be approving projects that we are writing throughout the rest of this year. And then in February, these projects are ranked by a regional ranking team. And then in this time, we find out what projects are funded, and then the money's available July 1st. A quick synopsis on how these projects are ranked. I can send you a ranking sheet if you'd like, but basically there's a focus area that we have as a UPCD team, and we create these focus areas. If your project's in a focus area, it's going to rank out a little higher. There is a wildlife component to this effort, this initiative, and so if your project's going to benefit a game species, you get points. If it benefits a sensitive species, you get points. So, for example, if you have a riparian restoration project and you can show in your proposal that it's going to benefit wild turkeys, for example, you get points. And if you can, in your proposal, demonstrate that it'll benefit yellow-billed cuckoo, you'll get additional points. So those are something to consider. Other questions here, you know, how does it improve water quality and water quantity? Another field here is, you know, what are the risks of this project? What are the risks if you don't do the project? And then another slide here talks about, you know, what's the management of this area after you do this project? How can you ensure that this project is going to be successful long term? Are you resting it from cattle for a few years? What's the management going to be like? And then there's also your project's also ranked on what kind of monitoring you're going to have. Are you going to have vegetation monitoring, photo points, wildlife monitoring, you know, some type of water quality or quantity monitoring? The more monitoring you have, the higher you're going to, the more points you're going to rank on that particular question. So, like I mentioned earlier, we give grants to numerous organizations, you know, to the BLM, to the Forest Service, to other state agencies, to private landowners, to nonprofit groups like the Nature Conservancy, or in our area we have, you know, Rim to Rim Restoration or Plateau Restoration, and these groups can all apply and qualify for grants. These grants are reimbursement type grants, so the money's available starting July 1. We enter into a cooperative agreement up to, you know, every quarter you can send us a receipt or an invoice, and we'll reimburse you for the, we go out and certify and make sure the work is done, and then we reimburse you for the money that you've spent up to that point. I think WRI is pretty flexible in what we can fund. We fund a lot of things. We fund labor, so both for your organization to actually go out and do the project, we can reimburse some of the money that it takes for that type of labor, or we can reimburse you for the money that it takes for you to hire a contractor to do the labor, or a youth core group, or whoever's doing the labor. WRI can fund that. We also fund things like archaeology clearances. Every time we turn over dirt, state law requires us to make sure that area doesn't have any archaeology. And so this grant can fund archaeology clearances. It can also provide, you know, purchase materials, trees, shrubs, water control structures, you know, small tools. If you're planting along in a dry area and you want to put in a little irrigation system, this grant can help fund that. We also provide a lot of seed. both in riparian areas and upland areas. Some things that we don't fund in WRI are land and easement acquisitions, big pieces of equipment like bobcat skid steers or tractors. There's unfortunately not a lot of money for us to fund monitoring and research. We don't fund water development like guzzlers, and we usually try to stay away from funding administrative costs. Here's just a few projects that have been funded in the last few years in the southeastern part of the state of Utah. These grants that are on the screen here have gone out to a variety of agencies, and some of the grants have been $10,000 to $20,000, and some have been, you know, $100,000 plus. So grants come in all forms and sizes. You can develop your proposal and ask for $10,000, or you can ask for $100,000 plus. There's not a match requirement either, but usually the more match you can show, the more partners you can show, the better, and the more likely it is to get funded. But certainly projects get funded 100% with zero match, and sometimes people ask for just 10% match. So we see everything. Just a real quick example of one project we have in the southeastern part of the state, the San Rafael Restoration Project. It relates to the work that we probably all of us are doing. This was actually an NRCS grant that we received through one of their Farm Bill programs. It paid for 75% of all the restoration cost on this project, and it's still ongoing. It's been going for 4 or 5 years now. But where WRI came in is WRI paid for the remaining 25% as match, and this project did a lot of great things. Both the NRCS and WRI paid for removal of the tamaricks. You can see they put it into piles here. It paid for a contractor to come in and pull out each individual tamaricks by the root and pile it up. And this grant paid for part of the contracting for those workers. It paid for an agency, Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, to come in and burn these piles. It helped pay for the reseeding effort that we took on afterwards. And anyways, that was that project. I'm out of time here, but here's my contact information. If you have any questions at all, feel free to call me or email me. We have biologists who work with private landowners as well, and biologists who work with the different government agencies. Tyler Thompson at the bottom of the screen here, he's kind of our statewide coordinator who directs a lot of this effort. But that's all I got. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. That was really informative, and I have some questions that I'll ask at the end of or at the tail end of the webinar here. Our next presenter is Rich Writing. He is the State Lead Program Manager with Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. In this role, he has built the Invasive Species Mitigation Program using funding from the Utah Legislature. He has worked as a field inspector in many agriculture-related programs, including invasive noxious weeds. I will pull up your presentation here, Rich, and you can unmute.
Okay.
And take it away.
Okay, great. Thanks. I appreciate the chance to get to talk about our department program and the things that we're going to be doing and things we have done. I enjoyed Chris's presentation. I know WRI is a great program. They do a lot of good things for the state, and we try and work in conjunction with them. I'll go over that a little bit a little later in the presentation, but they have a lot of things that they can do, and we have some things that we can do, and a lot of times people will use the two to leverage their grants, and it seems to work really well, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But anyway, our program here in the Department of Agriculture is called the Invasive Species Mitigation Noxious Weed Program. Here in the department, we have statutory authority for control and eradication of noxious weeds. We have state noxious weeds. We have county noxious weeds. Counties can declare their own species of noxious weeds if they're not declared by the state. So we try and manage all that. Under state statutory law, each county is responsible for the weeds in their county. So the counties generally fund most of their projects and most of their programs And then we try and step in and help where we can with grant monies and things like that. So let me go to the next slide here. So our mission statement in this for the department is to promote the healthy growth of Utah agriculture and conserve our natural resources and protect our food supply. We do that through improved communication, awareness of agriculture, conserve and enhance Utah's lands and natural resources. And we ensure food safety and consumer protection. And we try and do that through building partnership advocates and develop agricultural leaders. So as you can see, our primary focus is on ag and ag-related issues. But since noxious weeds don't just stay on ag land like they used to, we do get into a lot of different areas. And that's one of the main reasons that we enjoy working with WRI and some of the other groups in the state so that we can work on those types of projects. Now, there is a strategic management plan for the entire state for control of noxious and invasive weeds. Up till about a year to a year and a half ago, we had a management plan, but we didn't have any money to go with it. So we petitioned the state legislature, and we had Senator Ralph Okerlund presented to the legislature the need for invasive species funding. And so last year, the state legislature granted $1 million of ongoing money to attack and to make an effective first step in combating invasive weeds. This year also, they also allocated another $1 million for that same program. So right now our program stands at $2 million, and that is similar to Chris's in that it starts on July 1st of every year and ends on June 30th. So we're right now just wrapping up our first funding cycle. So we've had some really good projects this year. I'll go over some of the things that we've done, but I think we've made a pretty good difference in the first year of the program. So Utah is divided up in, besides just the county programs, it's also divided up into cooperative weed management areas. And I'm sure a lot of you have already heard about that and are probably working in those types of areas. I know the Tamarisk Coalition does great work with all the different CWMAs in the eastern portion of the state, so I won't go over that. But there are different groups, and they all, normally there's a county weed supervisor who's kind of heads up the group, or maybe a natural resources person who heads up the group, and then they'll switch chairman from time to time and bring in BLM and Forest Service and all those types of entities. So just this is just a quick little indication of how fast weeds can get away from us. This is a small area of Russian knapweed that we had originally mapped in 2005. Down towards Fairview, and within about 5 years, it had quadrupled in size. So it's amazing how fast these weeds can get away from us if we don't get right on them and try and do the early detection and rapid response. One of the main focus weeds we had for this year, and we do have focus areas, but mainly we have focus weeds right now, the ones that we're really interested in, and one of those is square rose knapweed. It's a huge problem. It creates monocultures. It takes out all types of plants, grasses, forbs. It'll squeeze out anything on the rangeland. So that is one of our target species for last year and also for this year. It was originally brought in on a shipment of grain down in the Eureka area, Tindic Junction area. And this is just a picture showing the weed board at that time. They were looking at a very small patch of square rose knapweed, and that was the extent of it right there from what you can see. And unfortunately, I think we studied it too long, and so now we have approximately 200,000 acres of it. If it, in that time period, it's gotten away from us from the time it was initially introduced. So we don't want that to happen to some of our other weeds. We're trying to make sure that the ones that are important don't get extended to this extent. And it causes forage losses. It's a huge reduction in wildlife, and it increases fire suppression costs. It really contributes to wildland fires, which is another thing that we're working hard to combat right now. And this just shows the epicenter where it began. At these grain silos is kind of where everything's tied back to. This is where the contaminated grain was stored. And now this is kind of just a quick picture of how far it's gotten away in the state. It's mainly in Tooele, Juab counties, and some in Millard County, but it is located all over the state in spot areas. So the first thing that happens, of course, is the invasion. The weeds get completely inundated in an area, and then we have to go in and treat those. So the first thing to do is we go in and normally we'll go in with a spray treatment program. And that can either be from the air or it can also be from the ground. A lot of times some of the areas are sensitive, so we have to go in and treat it with ground equipment, not just air spray of the areas, so that we can target the weeds that we want and not all the species in the area. Then once we've done that, then we try and develop plans to do the revegetation. So our treatments have to match what we're going to revegetate with so that we don't put on a pre-emergent and kill out the seed that we just put in. And then this just shows a picture of some of the land that's been restored in the Tinnick Junction. And it becomes suitable for forage, it becomes suitable for wildlife, and it becomes a usable piece of property rather than what it was in the beginning. So it takes an incredible amount of cooperation, and we do work together in these weed areas with all these different agencies. And our ISM funds are not specifically targeted for private ground, but they do seem to work better on private ground and state ground. The legislature, when they appropriated the funds, did put a clause in the statute that if work is done on federal land, that it has to be matched dollar for dollar. So the federal agency has to match dollar for dollar that grant. So it is more suited for private and state use at this time anyway. And we have steering committees that will go through and identify focus areas where the weeds are a real problem, so that we can then, when we do our ranking process on our weeds, then we can go ahead and focus on those areas, similar to what WRI does with their focus areas, so that we can use our money and make it go as far as we can. And then we get out in the field and we do all our planning out in the field and trying to organize everybody, and that in itself can be a feat, just trying to get everybody to go the right direction and spray in the right areas. But it's a great effort. These are some of the grant funds that we gave out this last year. This is the projects that we funded. We were able to fund last year the $900,000, and that was with the first initial million. And now this year we'll have some additional money. And part of that money will go towards the fire efforts, the wildland fire control that the legislature has asked us to do with the invasive species. So we're still in the process of ranking those grants. We received 56 grants this year, and the total request was $2.3 million. So we'll probably have approximately $1.5 million that we'll be able to allocate toward grants. So we're in the process of ranking those now. Should have those done probably by the end of this month. So our projects that we did this year, we did approximately 3,800 square acres of square rose knapweed, 2,500 acres of rush skeleton weed, which is a weed coming in across the Idaho border that we're quite concerned about, and then Medusa head, which is also coming in across the Idaho border area. We did about 2,000 acres. And then Phragmites, we funded a project on Utah Lake in conjunction with the Watershed Restoration Initiative to treat approximately 1,700 acres of Utah Lake shoreline, and the project's been very successful. And other weed species, about 31,000. So total amount of acres treated this year was about 41,000. And this just shows the other species that were treated in addition to the ones just mentioned. There's musk thistle, black henbane, Dyer's woad, and those type of species. These are some of the county designated noxious weeds, and we have our list on our ranking list. We tell the people putting in for the grants what weeds we're concerned with. Those are our priority weeds. And then a county can also, or any other agency, can put a weed that they feel like is important to them and then justify the reason for that. And then we can take that into consideration when we're doing our grant ranking. So we try and partner with WRI on the sage-grouse initiative. We're concerned with bringing back habitat for sage-grouse, as WRI is also. And so we work together with the Grazing Improvement Program, which is out of the Department of Agriculture, and then the WRI, and then our group, the ISM. And we all target increasing the acres for sage-grouse. So the Watershed Restoration Initiative, they do a great job of doing the pinnated juniper removal and removal of undesirable vegetation or invasive species. And then they do an excellent job of reseeding and rehabilitation and monitoring. And with that, they have the benefit of preventing the listing of the sage-grouse as an endangered species. And they also have the added benefit of helping to control wildland fires, because they create mosaic fire breaks in the areas that they treat and do their treatments. And then in the ISM program and the GIP program, we work closely together to improve grazing and also remove undesirable vegetation and do the reseeding. And with we also help to keep the sage-grouse from being listed by increasing those areas, such as areas that are inundated with cheatgrass. They can then become a habitat for sage-grouse. But then we also put in what we call green strips of like forage kochia and areas that help slow fires down or help make fire breaks to prevent the wildland fires. So that our main emphasis right now is the cheatgrass, and we're going to put some money towards that this year to try and rehabilitate cheatgrass areas so they can become the sage-grouse habitat. Like I say, the fire season last year was incredible. We had about 1,000 fires, so we're working closely with Forestry, Fire and State Lands, BLM, and some of the other groups to develop some project areas where we can keep that from happening. This just shows kind of a green strip that has been planted in northern Utah. On the left is a slide in the Milford Flat area. This shows where grazing took place and where grazing didn't take place. So grazing can be an important component when you're trying to control wildland fires. On the right side of the screen, or the right side of that picture, is an area that was grazed, and on the left side is an area that was ungrazed. And you can see there's no other fire break except just the fence. So you can see the grazing practices had an effect on the fire. And then this green stripping on the right is going to have even more of an effect. And then the WRI program, like I say, they have the mosaic fire breaks you can see up through the pinyon juniper, and that also slow fires down and increase grouse habitat. And this is just a picture of brush skeleton weed. This is the weed that we're concerned about in northern Utah. It is on our list of targeted species. This is just what it looks like with the flowers. It's it also forms a monoculture and chokes out every other vegetation that is around it. This is the other project, a targeted species. This is Medusa head, and this is prevalent up in Cache Valley right now. We've got several thousand acres that we're working on. This is a picture from up in that area, and you can see the biggest problem with Medusa head is it's not good for forage, for wildlife, or for animals, and it also has a huge potential for fire. It's even more inflammable than cheatgrass. This shows where we've done some some surveying with remote sensing to determine where those areas might be that have the new Medusa head infestations. And this is up in the southern part of Cache Valley. It's just another picture of the same thing, just trying to delineate where we have it and where we don't, and target some treatments. This is what it looks like in the spring. It's actually fair for forage for about 2 weeks of the year, similar to cheatgrass, and then it immediately goes brown and has a high silica content, and the cattle won't eat it and wildlife won't eat it. And again, it has a huge potential for fire danger. Now, with the seed heads the way they are, they create an airspace that makes it very flammable. And Phragmites, this is just a picture of Saratoga Bay on Utah Lake. You can see that as it forms a monoculture, it makes it impossible to recreate. It makes it impossible for people to use the lake. It goes out into the water, and even fish can't swim through the roots, and birds can hardly nest in it. And this shows just the creeping rhizomes that it spreads by seed and by rhizomes. So we would like to treat Phragmites as much as we can, but the problem is there's so much of it, we don't want to use all our grant funding up in 1 year, or actually take more than that. But this is just an acreage estimate on Phragmites in the state, and we think there's about 70,000 some odd acres around the major lakes, and that would put a price tag of about $16 million to treat it all just once. That's not even retreat or regrowth or anything like that. So it's going to take some time to get a handle on Phragmites, and it's not going to be a quick and easy fix. They do use fire to control Phragmites. As some of you have probably seen it burn. It burns with very heavy black smoke, and so they have trouble getting permission from air quality to even use fire as a treatment. So normally they spray it and then just try and knock it down and get it to biodegrade. It is cool when it burns, though. And then they go back in and resurvey and try and find the species that are still viable, and then try and do restoration work in that area. It's amazing how much comes back after the Phragmites is gone. You get the hard stem bulrush and that coming back in pretty quick. This is just an area after treatment on one of the dikes at Utah Lake, and you can see that they've done a really good job of cleaning it up. It makes it so the public can use the lake again. And just another species that we're concerned with is giant reed, Arundo donax, and we funded one project down in southern Utah this year in Washington County to control this species. It's actually larger than Phragmites and causes even more problems. It forms, again, a monoculture, and it has huge stems. So as far as we know right now, it's limited to Washington County, but we've funded a project also for camel thorn. This is camel thorn down in San Juan County, another invasive that is hard for wildlife and for domestic animals to compete with. So, and these are some of the challenges we're facing, just the new invasions from different types of weeds from our surrounding states. And the coordination, of course, is always an ongoing effort, trying to work with different agencies. And the seed movement from recreational vehicles and spread of invasive species by animals, by grazing animals, and then, of course, lack of resources and equipment is always going to be in. There's never going to be enough money to do everything you want. But part of our funding, when we do our ranking, we have a ranking sheet that is available online you can look at. But the main things we look at are if you have multiple partner involvement, so that you have different areas of money and things to bring to the table. We look at if you're going to be monitoring, mapping your area, what type of monitoring you're going to use. We want there to be some kind of a plan put together so that we know what you're going to do in year one, year two, year three, you know, because we know that these are multi-year projects and multi-year things that have to be done. So we want you to think in terms of a plan of action so that we know that you're going to make some kind of a difference on it. And then, and again, we focus on targeted species. So on our website, we have a list of those weed species that we feel are important right now. And then we want to make sure that you have a future management in your plan so that once you've done the control on species that you're going to be able to plan for the future. So anyway, that's kind of what I've got. I appreciate all the work that's been done, and I encourage anyone to apply for these grants, and I think that it's a good program.
Great. Thank you so much, Rich. That was very informative. Next, we are going to have Natalie Conlon speak. She is the Southeast Area Forester for the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, which is part of the Utah Department of Natural Resources. She's based at the Moab office and works with private landowners in the high-elevation forested areas of the state. Recently, her division has become involved in tamarisk projects because they are found on state and sovereign lands and private lands, and they have fire hazards, as we all know. I'm going to pull up your presentation, Natalie, if you'll unmute yourself.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. A moment here. All right, take it away.
All right, well, this is just a presentation of the tamarisk and riparian-related funding that our division can offer to private landowners. That's mainly who we work with. We also manage our state sovereign lands, which are defined as the riverbeds of the navigable waterways at statehood. And in southeastern Utah, that's mainly along the Colorado and Green Rivers. Our two main funding programs that are related to riparian areas are the Redesign Grant Program and the National Fire Plan. And a large part of our funding for our division comes from the U.S. Forest Service, and these two grants are funneled through them to our state and private forestry program. This is on our website, this map, but our division is divided into six areas, and each area has a variety of similar positions, and so the area forester in each area is the person who applies for the redesign grant funding, and then we also have a national fire plan coordinator who applies for that funding, and we also have sovereign lands coordinators where we do have sovereign lands, which is southeastern Utah, Wasatch Front, and the Bear River area. So this is helpful for if you have a project in mind, you'll know who to contact in which area. This is just a before and after of a redesign and National Fire Plan, and actually WRI-funded project in Castle Valley, just outside of Moab. A little before and after of a tamarisk that was removed underneath a cottonwood canopy. And then the material was chipped and left on site. But people often ask me, what are foresters doing involved with riparian and tamarisk issues? And basically, in regards to fire prevention, riparian areas run through a lot of our cities and towns, and they've become fire issues. And that's how we've gotten involved with the National Fire Plan. And also, one of our missions is to control invasive species forested in private areas. And, of course, increase water quality and quantity, improve river function, and encourage native tree regeneration. So I'm going to start with the competitive redesign grants, which is, as I mentioned before, through the U.S. Forest Service. The division submits four applications a year. I believe each state is able to submits, I think it's three or four single-state applications and one multi-state application. It's a three-year grant, and it's $300,000 with a 50-50 match required, and that's non-federal match. The project needs to integrate all of our state and private forestry programs, which include forest health, urban and community forestry, and stewardship. And it has to show that we are collaborating with partners, state, nonprofit, and private entities. And we also have a state assessment document, also called the Forest Action Plan, and that is on our website as well. It's produced every 5 years. The last one was 2010. And it's a document that we're required to have to show our priority issues and areas we'll be concentrating on for that time period. And if the redesign grant proposal, that has to fall, well, it's encouraged to fall within one of our priority areas. And the application itself, these are sort of the different criteria that must be met. And there is, similar to WRI, there's a ranking committee and a ranking score sheet that can help you fill out your application. And the Western Forestry Leadership Coalition website, which will be on my next slide, actually is a good place for guidance and more information on the application process. The ranking committee is composed of various folks, mostly state and federal forestry folks from all of the Western U.S. states. It's a very competitive program, and actually since I produced this slide only a couple of weeks ago, it is out of date. The redesign funding this year was actually cut by 5%. So this year, 16 out of 68 Western state proposals were actually funded, which totals a little under $5 million. Awarded this year. And again, that is the website for more information on the redesign program. Over the past, I guess, 6 years or so, since our division has become involved in the redesign program, everything in red is Tamarisk-related grants that we have received throughout the state. The whole list are the applicants. Applications we put in and were funded. But we received a good part of riparian-related funding. This is one in southwestern Utah, managed out of our Cedar City office, the Virgin River Restoration. And it's been a multi-phase project. And as you saw in the previous slide, it's received three different grants, actually. And it involves several partners, state, cities especially. It's a real urban forestry-focused project. Here's just another site of a project site along the Virgin. And grant-funded activities included several parts, of course, noxious weed / tamarisk removal, and restoration and planting of native species. And the cities in southwestern Utah around St. George were heavily involved, putting together community tree management plans, and they have a lot of real active groups with tree planting. Another redesign-funded project close to Moab was the Tamarisk Eradication and Native Tree Revegetation Project, which ends this year. And basically, it was designed to fill in the gaps on state and private lands between the already treated areas that have been completed over the years, mostly by the BLM. And this is a map of the proposed area and where we have been working the last 3 years. The redesign grant provided funding to project work everywhere from Westwater Canyon through to Potash and a few of the tributaries, including Castle Creek, Mill Creek, and Pack Creek. This is another project site just outside of Moab, another tamarisk removal underneath a cottonwood gallery before and after. And you'll also see some paint on the trees in the after photo showing we had a crew go in and apply sand paint to the base of the trees to prevent any potential damage from beavers. Grant-funded activities on this project, it's very similar to the Virgin River Project, and we also did a lot of public education and outreach, There were some documents that were mailed out to landowners across the state, such as Utah Forest News, and several signs have been put up, and there were some public and educational events over the years, just explaining what we were doing in the area and who provided the funding. The application process usually starts in April. That's when this year it's running a little late, it seems, but the applications are usually on that Western Forestry Leadership website around April or May. The deadline is September, and then the grant notification to our division is usually around December or January, and then it would begin the next state fiscal year, June, or end of June. And another program is the National Fire Plan Program, and this is federally sourced funding for the WUI zone, which is the wildland-urban interface around communities. And it's a little more specific for where we can apply for funding. The project must be located within an existing community wildfire protection plan community. It must have a fire prevention component, such as creating defensible space or fuel breaks around a community. And it must be within close proximity to a community or individual homes. And one part of the National Fire Plan funding is the Stevens Grants. And for Stevens funding, the project actually has to be directly adjacent to an existing or planned Forest Service project. That really narrows down the areas where you can apply for National Fire Plan funding. So in summary, all of our projects are pretty heavily involved with other partners. As foresters and land managers, we're not necessarily riparian experts, so we rely on our partners' expertise heavily. An example project is this one along Mill Creek in town that has been going on for several years. It's received funding from the National Fire Plan, Redesign, WRI, City of Moab, Grand County, and several nonprofit groups in the area. How it relates to the National Fire Plan is it's fire prevention work. And there's a Moab Valley CWPP already in place, so it qualified for the NFP funding that way. And the Grand County Weed Department participates by doing follow-up spraying on projects for us as well. So for more information, I just put in our southern offices where our Tamarisk work has been mainly concentrated. And you can contact either myself or Sarah, my counterpart, in our Cedar City office. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Natalie. Our next presenter is Jim Bocut. He is the Utah State Nonpoint Source Solution Program Coordinator for the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, Division of Water Quality. In this role, he oversees the Utah statewide Nonpoint Source Solution Program. He has also worked closely with the Utah Division of Water Quality to collect water quality information that would be used by the state to develop total maximum daily loads. Previously, Jim has worked for the Utah State University as a local watershed coordinator. And Jim, I'm going to pull up your presentation here, and you can unmute yourself.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Great. Take it away.
All right. As was previously mentioned, I work for the Division of Water Quality. For the Division of Water Quality, I oversee two programs that I've been asked to talk about. And to be able to understand these programs, I felt like it was important to understand what the goal of the Utah Division of Water Quality Watershed Protection Section is, which is the section that I am under. That is to protect and restore the water quality of our streams, lakes, and groundwater resources. I've given a few grant writing 101 seminars, and one of the things that I make as a point in those seminars is when you're applying for funding, make sure you understand exactly what the goal of the program is, and when you're writing your proposals, write them so that you can help them achieve the goals that they have for that funding. And so if it involves the protection of streams, lakes, and groundwater, or if it involves the restoration or removing water bodies from the 33D list of impaired water bodies. Those are the kind of proposals that we usually fund and entertain when we are going through the approval process. And recently in 2010, when I was brought in, they decided that they would try a different approach at reducing non-point source pollution from the waters of the state. When I was brought on in 2010, they simply accepted applications from anywhere in the state. It could have been southern Utah, it could have been northern Utah, and they funded applications from all around the state as well. And well, those projects did have water quality benefits. At times it felt like they were more random acts of conservation, and it was very difficult to be able to understand or be able to observe the water quality benefits that those projects had. So the approach that the Division of Water Quality has moved to in the recent years is more of a targeted basin approach. And in this targeted basin approach, we expect the people in the watershed to go out and do quite a bit of research before they apply for the funding. We currently have 9 watershed coordinators that are stationed throughout the state, and these watershed coordinators facilitate many of the watershed groups that are around the state. And they can go out and they can help collect the water quality data within those watersheds. And once the water quality data is collected, it hopefully gives the watershed a feel for where the water quality issues are within that watershed. And once they've figured out what section of the watershed they want to focus in on, then they develop a watershed plan. And the watershed plan is very useful in identifying the sources of non-point source pollution. They also help determine the BMPs that can be implemented to help reduce the non-point source pollution in that area of the watershed. They're useful in providing cost estimates for the implementation plan, and they also help us understand, you know, where we should conduct monitoring in the future as well. And once they've identified those areas, we're able to spend money there. But besides the local level, the other way that we've been able to go to a targeted approach is we've gone to a 6-basin rotational system where the Division of Water Quality gives the majority of its funding to one of these targeted basins in the state. And if you look at the map here, you can see that the 6 basins that are up there, the first basin is the Jordan River Utah Lake Basin. We also have the Colorado Basin, which is a fairly large basin, the Sevier Cedar Beaver Basin, the Bear River, the Weaver River, and the Uinta Basin as well. And so what we do is we have our monitoring crews, and they will go out 2 years before we are going to put the majority of our funding on the ground, and they will do an intensive monitoring run where they will help gather the data that will be used for writing those watershed plans. Once that data has been collected, we give them 2 years to be able to write those watershed plans. And once the plans are written and they need the money to implement those plans, we then make that funding available to them. So currently the Division of Water Quality uses 2 funding sources to obtain our goals of improving and protecting water quality. We have the state non-point source funding. This is funding that's been awarded to us through the Water Quality Board to address non-point source related issues. We have the state revolving funds, which we use to give loans to municipalities and other large agencies that are requesting grants, and we charge an interest rate on that funding, and that is where we get the funding for the non-point source funding is through those loans to the larger municipalities. The other grant program that we have is a Section 319 program. This is federal funding that is given to us through EPA. Section 319 of the Clean Water Act says that to address non-point source pollution, Each state should implement a voluntary program that people can join based on incentives. And every year we receive approximately $1.3 million. But out of that, after we've funded our staff and things in that regard and spend the money on watershed planning, we usually have about $500,000 in Section 319 funding that we use for implementation of the projects that are out there. So a little bit more detail on the Section 319 grants. We'll talk about them first. First of all, it's used to restore and protect the beneficial uses of the waters of the state. Those beneficial uses could be a cold water fishery, warm water fishery, recreational use, drinking water. There's various beneficial uses that are out there, but these Section 319 grants have to be used to help protect or restore these beneficial uses. The grants have a 60-40 cost share requirement. 60% can be paid by the grant. 40% needs to be matched, and this match can be in-kind or can be a monetary match from other funding sources. You cannot use federal funding as a source of match for these grants. And then we also have the funding needs to be spent within 3 years once it has been awarded to the entity that has received that grant. This is the 319 funding is tied very heavily to the targeted basin. So those six targeted basins that we showed you and their schedule in which they're going to receive that funding, the majority of the 319 funding is going to go into the targeted basin for that year. However, the same is not, it's not the same for the state non-point source funding, and I'll talk about that later, but the state non-point source funding can be used or applied for any year and awarded to any watershed throughout the state. But the 319 funding, all of that will go into the targeted basin. A watershed plan must be developed prior to any project implementation with Section 319 funding. Project monitoring is required. We've been taking a lot of heat from EPA lately to be able to show the benefits of the projects that we implement on the ground. All non-federal entities are eligible to apply. The projects that we fund with these 319 fundings are typically on-the-ground project implementation, projects that reduce non-point source pollution. These can be sprinkler systems. They can be, removing animal feedlots from riparian corridors. It can be stream restoration. It can even be upland projects, as long as it can be documented that the project has a benefit in reducing non-point source pollution, it can usually be funded. We can do information and education type projects. Technical assistance and engineering can all be covered under these Section 319 grants. The only thing that that we get a little bit worried about with our 319 funding and our state non-point source for that matter is the purchasing of equipment. If it's over $5,000, we'll need special permission and we'll need to fill out special paperwork to be able to approve the grant if it's for larger equipment. Now, for the state non-point source pollution grants, there is no set cost share requirement for this, but we recommend a 90-10% cost share, so 90% of the project can be covered by the grant, and 10% needs to be covered by the cooperator. This is especially in areas where private producers are implementing the project. We just feel like if they put in a little bit of their own effort and a little bit of their own money, they take a little bit more ownership in the project, and they're a little bit more apt to maintain the project. With the state non-point source funding, the grants can't exceed $150,000 without special approval from the Water Quality Board. And as I mentioned previously, applications can be accepted from all over the state with the state non-point source funding. It's not going to all be put into the targeted basin. And there are no limitations on who can apply for the state non-point source funding. So some examples of the projects we've funded in the past and the ones that we are planning on funding in the future. The Strawberry River Project, I think, is a really good example of the type of project we like to fund in the state of Utah, mainly because we were able to do contiguous stretches of river along this section of the Strawberry. If you can see on the upper right-hand picture there, there are several partners that came on board to implement this project, including the Forest Service, Trouts Unlimited, us, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Division of Wildlife Resources, and it has just been a really successful project. And we have already, I believe that there, the project is around 8 river miles, and they've already completed around 6 miles of that, and in this coming year we plan on finishing up the remaining 2 miles or so, 2.36 miles of the project. And so this has been a really good project, and we're really excited to see the outcomes after we go in and do the monitoring afterwards. Another project that we have been putting a lot of effort into recently is in East Canyon Creek. The impairment here is for phosphorus and for temperature. So I have here a few pictures that that we have from the project. The project on the left-hand side was implemented 2 or 3 years ago. The project on the right-hand side we just implemented last year. We found a lot of success in using the coconut fibrous netting as far as allowing the projects to remain stable. This project here, they proposed to stabilize 5.4 miles of the project of the river. They have recently completed about 2.8 miles, and they're planning on finishing up the rest of the project here in the next year or two. One of the things that we really look for when projects are being submitted to us and when we're receiving applications is if the projects are in areas where other agencies are working or if they're in areas where we have funded projects in the past. We prefer to put all of our efforts into one watershed if we can in the general area. Down at the bottom, you can see a continuous monitoring station. We fund a lot of the monitoring that goes on in these projects as well. And as I mentioned in, previously, we do want to be able to understand if our money is going towards a worthy cause, if we're actually reducing the pollutants that are in the water. And so monitoring is very important, and it's a very common parameter that we fund in these grants as well. The Sandpitch River is another area where we have been putting quite a bit of money recently. We have several stream miles that we have restored on the Sandpitch River, most of it around Fairview, around in that area. You can see the project on the upper left-hand side. That was a project that was implemented probably 3 or 4 years ago. You can see we're already getting some good growth on the willows. The one at on the bottom was implemented 2 years ago, I believe, and we do have, you know, good vegetation coming in. The willows are coming along all right, and the one that's up on the upper right-hand side was one that was actually just implemented last year. So as far as the invasives go, I was going to touch on this on the next slide. We typically don't fund projects that focus solely on removing invasives. At one point we did, and we spent well over $100,000 down on the Virgin River to remove tamarisk, and we spent quite a bit in the Price River watershed and things in that regard. But EPA started to get concerned about that and mentioned that they felt like there was other funding available to address invasives. But on that same note, we still realized that you know, treating invasives is an important part of watershed management. When we go in and we have a project in the Price River and there's a bunch of tamarisks in the riparian corridor where we will be working, we'll go ahead and we'll clear out all the tamarisk in that stretch of river so the native vegetation can come back in and be able to grow and help stabilize those stream banks. And also just so it's, you know, we just as well, while we're in there and we're tearing out the species, we just as well kill two birds with one stone. But we won't go into a stretch of river just because there's tamarisk there. We usually go in because there is another specified water quality concern, whether it be eroding stream banks or animal feedlots or things in that regard. The other thing, too, we usually, when we go in and implement the stream bank project, when we disturb the soil, there's usually a lot of invasives that will come in after that. whether it be thistle or things like that. And we will pay for the cooperator to go in and keep putting pesticides down on those weeds to be able to control them. We realize that the last thing that any landowners want are invasive species coming in areas where we disturb the soil. So it's not completely out of the question to be able to spend this funding on noxious and invasive species. But for the most part, we usually just focus on the water quality aspects. And the other thing, too, if you can come in and you have a project where you want to remove tamarisk or remove Russian olive, if it's included in the watershed plan, that by doing that, it will improve water quality. We will be able to fund those projects, but it needs to be identified in the watershed plan. And that's all I have. If there's any questions, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jim. That was great. I think that you answered a lot of questions that I know I had about the role of some of these water quality-related funding sources to invasive plants. So I'm going to open up the rest of the webinar for questions. If you have questions, you can press star 1 on your phone, and I will answer them in the order that they are asked. One question for you, Jim, is I wonder if do you have any examples of projects where there has been a correlation between the presence of invasive tamarisk, Russian olive, and water quality that you can cite?
I don't have any hard science, and this was the debate that we had with EPA when they asked us about it, what water quality impairments are actually being caused by the tamarisks that are out there. When we asked that question to many of our producers or the people that were receiving the grants, we heard some of them say that, they were channelizing the river and thus it was incising the stream and causing downgrading in the water channel. But when it comes right down to it, when we ask for the hard science, we haven't had a lot of correlation that way. And so, I can't say that we've necessarily seen a correlation. If somebody has a correlation, I'd love to see it. And as I mentioned, if someone wants to apply for the funding and they can make a good case that by removing the tamarisk and the Russian olives that it will improve water quality, we definitely will listen and we're not opposed to funding them. So.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So I think we haven't seen any questions from our audience yet, but for our first three presenters, each of you mentioned something about monitoring as being a component of the project work or of the grant application itself, but none of you gave examples of projects that you'll fund for the purpose of monitoring, as far as I could tell. So I wonder if you could speak to that and whether that's a component of these grant programs, or if that's something that you will not fund or if it has to be a component of implementation work.
So for WRI, I think WRI is asking the agency or the organization or the landowner applying for the grant to do monitoring on their own time and their own dime. WRI doesn't fund monitoring, but like you mentioned, it's if you need to address monitoring in your proposal, and the better the monitoring, the more you'll get, the higher score you'll get for that component of the ranking sheet. So that's the case for WRI. Does that answer your question?
So effectively, you can't put together a grant application that's going to be exclusively monitoring and expect that it will be funded through WRI.
That's correct. I think there has been a few cases where people have added, $1,000 or $500 as part of their project budget. Their project budget could be they're asking for $50,000. And a small portion of that, they build it as a project budget to include time to monitor. And I believe WRI has funded projects like that. But you can't projects in the past that have asked for $20,000 to monitor these riparian areas have not been funded.
Okay. And that's a common situation, at least as far as I've encountered.
Yeah, and that's a frustration I've heard from numerous people. And fortunately, a lot of grants don't pay for monitoring like maybe they should.
Mm-hmm. Do you see an opportunity for that? Is there an opportunity to influence that or affect those criteria in any way?
I think people have tried to influence that. I don't know if it's gone farther. I think the WRI kind of prides itself in putting money on the ground and relying on partner resources to do the monitoring. So, you know, internal BLM staff or Forest Service or Division of Wildlife, we have our own monitoring system. And so I think we rely on our partners to kind of come up with funds or resources to do that for us.
Yeah, that makes sense. How about you, Rich?
Yeah, ISM is similar in that regard. When the legislature allocates our money, they ask that approximately 90% of it hit the ground. So any monitoring that we require is just monitoring as part of the project to show that that there's some progress being made. So actual monitoring of areas outside the project area are not really included in the grants.
Natalie, any thoughts on that subject?
Very similar to what Chris mentioned. Redesign is just focused on the groundwork. They don't favor research and monitoring in particular.
Okay, good thing. So we doesn't look like we have any questions. Again, if you have questions, you can press star 1 on your phone, and we will answer them in the order that they're asked. We also ask that everyone who's participating fill out a evaluation form, which can be accessed at the website link that is shown on our screen here. It looks like we might have a question in the text box. Says, question for Jim Bopek, can water quality funding go towards trails, slopes, stabilization projects in upland areas?
Yeah, it can. In fact, on the south slope of the Uintah in the Cart Creek watershed, we awarded a grant for this type of project up there and awarded it to the Forest Service. So, yes, it can be, as long as it's proven to be a water quality concern in that watershed.
I wonder, how about, and this is sort of the inverse of the monitoring question, but how about site assessment? Is that something that any of these grant projects or programs fund in terms of going into a site and doing sort of the preliminary work to determine what the purpose and need is for removal, revegetation, and so forth?
Is that the Division of Water Quality? Yes, we do award funding for that. If somebody wants to develop a watershed plan, but they're, you know, they don't have the manpower to be able to go in there and do that. For the most part, we would expect our local watershed coordinator to go in and do that type of work. But if, as I mentioned, if they're not present in that watershed, then we have funded water quality studies and funded the development of watershed plans in the past as well.
Okay. Yes, and with redesign too, we'll fund the putting together practice plans and management plans as part of the grant.
I haven't seen WRI pay for that sort of thing, but it doesn't mean that we wouldn't. I guess it depends on, you know, how much you're asking for and what, you know, the next steps are. If it was a preliminary study to do a great restoration project that would impact the watersheds and benefit wildlife species and all of the resources, then I think it could be considered.
For the ISM grants, we kind of require that up front from the people that are applying from the grant. So we kind of expect that they'll do the groundwork ahead of time and do the reconnaissance kind of thing and then apply for the funds. So I guess in that regard, we kind of depend on the county resources to fund that.
That makes sense. All right. Well, I think we are reaching the conclusion of the webinar. Did any of the presenters have anything you wanted to add or questions for each other?
I didn't. Thank you, though.
Absolutely. Thank you, each of you. Those were really informative presentations, and all of those will be available on our website within the next few days, and you can access those in the contact information and website that they mentioned. And the recorded the recording of this webinar will also be available on our website. I think that we've proven that there are a great number of resources available for this type of work in Utah, and it sounds like a lot of them can be leveraged against each other to create a really nice portfolio of work that can be accomplished. So I think that's really exciting, and thanks for everyone who called in to participate.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.